alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Would you try to cross a busy street blindfolded without an APS? And rideshare, the most popular way to reduce the cost of your daily commute. Sheila Steron and Janet Rogers of Transit Action Network, a Kansas City Regional Transit Advocacy Group, bring you Transit Talk on Radioactive Magazine. You can find us at transactionkc.com.
I'm Sheila Styron from The Whole Person, and I'm here to talk about accessible pedestrian signals. We're beginning today with Janet Barlow, who is president of Accessible Designs for the Blind. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for inviting me to be here on this.
Sure. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you do? Because there's a lot more to you than what I just said.
Well, I'm a certified orientation and mobility specialist. My experience over many years has been teaching people who are blind or who have low vision travel techniques for getting around their cities and towns. I particularly got interested in issues with intersections a number of years ago, working in Atlanta, when I realized I didn't really understand how traffic systems work very well. So I've been a member of the Institute for Transportation Engineers for a number of years and got to know a lot of traffic engineers and learned more about signals and got involved in the need and recognition of the need for accessible pedestrian signals as I learned more.
So why don't we get right into this, and why don't you tell people what an accessible pedestrian signal, or an APS as we like to refer to them, is exactly?
Well, an accessible pedestrian signal basically provides audible and vibrotactile indication about the visual walk signal that's provided for pedestrians. The new types of APS have 5 required features. They have what's called a push-button locator cone so that somebody can find the push-button at the tone that goes once per second. They have audible and vibrotactile, that means it vibrates, indication when the walk signal comes on so that you can either hear an indication that the walk is on as well as if you have your hand on the push-button you can feel it vibrate. Has a tactile arrow that's lined up with the direction of travel on the crosswalk, and they respond to ambient sound, so they get louder when the traffic is louder and quieter when the traffic is quiet. There's also some requirements with the new types of APS to be at a location that's within 5 feet of the crosswalk and integrated in the push button. Lots of features to look nowadays.
A lot of people wonder, why do these things have to make this noise? Why do I have to listen to this? And I just always like to remind people, as a person who actually is totally blind, that just imagine if you were standing at an intersection, standing on a sidewalk, all the cement around you, and you were looking for this skinny little pole and you couldn't see it. That's why they make all that noise. And without that, we don't have much of a chance of finding them.
And that's one of the things, too, though. They are supposed to be designed to be heard when you're at the crosswalk, but not all the way down the block. And sometimes that adjustment can be a little bit difficult to get right.
Oh, absolutely.
Feedback both back and forth on that.
Yeah, we don't want them too loud or too soft. These new location regulations will be helpful as well, because sometimes you'll have to go over into a patch of grass that's very far away from the intersection, and if it wasn't making a noise, you'd never find it over there, loud or
right,
soft.
I have no idea how to find it. And so locating them closer to the crosswalk will certainly help, both with not having to have them as loud as well as making it more efficient for everybody to use the push button are now required at many intersections.
Exactly. And how long have APS been around?
Well, there's been some type of accessible signals around since really there have been visual pedestrian signals. There were bells installed in the 1930s or possibly even earlier. Then in the early 70s, some cheap type signals, overhead, you may probably be familiar with those, were installed in the U.S. But really the newer type we're seeing now have been around since about the mid-1990s. They're like what's been installed in Australia and Europe for many more years, but really have been only installed in the U.S. in the last, since maybe 92 or 3, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Why aren't they everywhere? Why don't we just do that like we do regular traffic signals? I know, I'm asking you.
In my opinion, they should be everywhere.
I know.
They need to install a test signal.
I'm asking it a little naively, but why?
But I think it used to be that the way traffic moved, blind people could listen to the traffic movement, the signals were predictable, you could get to know at an intersection by listening through a few cyclists. So I think maybe a lot of people still are not requesting and feeling they need the accessible signal as much as maybe they do these days. With the signal changes in signal, the way they're worked in terms of computer control, it really is necessary to have some idea of when the traffic engineer has planned for pedestrians to walk. Because it may not be at the time you assume from hearing your parallel traffic move that's the correct time to walk. There may be a arrow allowing cars to turn and other things like that.
Do you anticipate a time when they will be absolutely required?
I am fairly certain that when the Access Board finally completes its public right-of-way rule, that it will require there to be accessible signals wherever pedestrian signals are installed. So if traffic engineer doesn't think that sighted pedestrians need to have a signal, then they may not have to install an accessible signal. But I'm fairly certain the Access Board, whenever that rule gets completed, will require the accessible signals as well, as part of any kind of pedestrian signal that's installed, which would mean that as a signal gets changed or installed, push button gets installed, that it would have accessible features as well.
And I know we've been talking about the Access Board ruling for a long time. Is there any intel on when it might happen?
Last I heard was spring of next year.
Okay, moving right along.
Yeah, it's not right away.
Yeah.
Hoping it'll be sooner.
Is there anything else that you would like to mention?
One of the things that I would encourage is that if people are having some difficulty crossing at an intersection, somebody is blind, low vision, that they make a request for that signal to be installed. I'm certainly, maybe it's not true in Kansas City, but in other cities I'm working in, I often hear from people who are blind or visually impaired that, oh, I'm having trouble crossing that street. I never can figure out the traffic. But they haven't actually made a request to the city for an ABS. And sometimes they're quite simple to install. If there's a push button there already, it can be replaced with a new type of signal. It may not be in an ideal location, but it may give a little bit more information about what's happening with the traffic there and provide a better idea of what's going on with the intersection. So I do encourage people to make that request and find out what's needed. And then also the agencies understand then that there's a need out there for those kinds of features.
Well, I want to thank you, Janet Barlow, for agreeing to participate in this discussion. And I am certain that our listeners have learned a lot from hearing what you've had to say. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheila. Appreciate the opportunity.
I'm speaking with Chris Locke, who is with Kansas City's Public Works Department, and we're going to talk about accessible pedestrian signals in Kansas City. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Sheila. It's always a pleasure to speak.
You too. Can you tell us a little more about who you are and what you do for Kansas City?
Absolutely. So I am with the City of Kansas City, Missouri Public Works Department, and I am a project manager in the traffic engineering section. And one of our special projects is handling the APS, Accessible Pedestrian Signals, installation at traffic signals throughout the city.
When did you first hear about accessible pedestrian signals?
You know, it's been at least 5 years since I've heard of them. We had one installed many years ago. It was a very early version. You know, it would be laughed at in today's technology.
Are you talking about the bird tweets down at Alpha Point?
Yes, that is the one I was referring to.
Well, tell us, what are your recollections of how we started down this path?
Yeah, so we started out slowly, basically because it was brand new technology for us at the time. We were a little leery of it at that time, like I said, but the feedback that we got from the communities and the advocacy groups was overwhelming. And what we did was we secured bond funding for installing dozens of them throughout the city. And so what we did was we prioritized a list based upon community feedback and meeting with advocacy groups, and then also reaching out to different agencies such as the KCATA and folks like that, and we set up a priority list of locations to install the mats. Now, we have also made the commitment to not only install them on an as-needed basis or as-requested basis, but the city of Kansas City has gone above them. Any modification to a traffic signal within the city or any brand new installation of a traffic signal within the city will be installed with the APS pedestrian signal.
And I, as a person who am blind and happen to use these signals on a daily basis, am very proud of Kansas City for having made that commitment. You said when you first started down the road, you had some concerns. What were those, and do you still face any obstacles surrounding the installation of apps?
You know, I did say that I was a little leery at first, and many of us were, just because of the new technology. And the early ones were a little less reliable. You could configure it and install it out in the field and come back a week later, and the volumes of the locate tone, and we can back up a little bit here and kind of explain to people what an APS is. When I start explaining APS to people, the first thing they say is, oh, well, those are the push buttons that talk to you. And that is really what they are. They provide information about the walk and the don't walk cycles at a traffic signal. And so anytime that you switch from a push button that doesn't provide any feedback at all, is basically just a piece of plastic colored red that someone hits and assumes that the call went into the controller. Anytime you switch from a technology as that to something as complex as these stations are, you're going to have issues. And so the volume issues are probably one of the most common complaints that we have received in the past. And like I said, you could set it one day and come back a week later and the thing is just beeping really, really loud. Now, the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices spells out that the tone, the locate tone, and the audible messages shall be heard from 6 to 12 feet away from the station or the building face that is closest to the intersection, whichever is closest. And that is to eliminate noise pollution. And unfortunately, close to residential areas or even office buildings downtown, we did get some complaints in regards to the overwhelming noise. People having their windows open could hear it and just were very concerned over if that was how the installation was supposed to be installed or if there was a malfunction. And so we would respond as quickly as possible and get out there. And you know, some of the units had to be sent back to the factory. It was a learning curve that we went through. And the manufacturers that we've used have listened to us. They've visited our city. They have committed to making these more reliable. And, I mean, it's really been a learning process for everybody, but absolutely for the better. And in the 5 years approximately that we've been installing these, I've seen a huge increase in the reliability of these units.
And probably in the public's understanding and acceptance as well, I'm sure. Can you tell people about the process for contacting the city and reporting a malfunctioning accessible pedestrian signal?
Yeah, the best place to request any service within the city is 311, and we can get that request rather quickly and dispatch a technician to the intersection and troubleshoot the problem. Sometimes it is literally an issue that the technician is able to fix right on site. Other times it is an APS that has been struck by a vehicle, and so that means the entire unit will have to be taken down and replaced. And other times it's a unit that is malfunctioning inside, and an internal malfunction, and will need to be sent back to the manufacturer to get repaired. But absolutely, 311 is the best one-stop shop for citizens to request a service for a malfunctioning APS.
Well, Chris, I just want to leave you with one more question. Do you know how many we have in Kansas City currently?
Yes, so we have approximately at this time about 160 of our traffic signals installed with APS. And to give you an idea of how many traffic signals we have altogether, is about 600. And the projects that we are working on currently, by the end of this calendar year, we should be up around 200 of our 600 with APS.
That's really good news, and I, for one, as I said earlier, am very appreciative every time I walk down a sidewalk and approach an intersection where I hear the locator tone on an accessible pedestrian signal. Thanks a lot, Chris. It's been great talking with you.
It's been great talking with you as usual, Sheila, and you take care.
My thanks to Janet Barlow, President of Accessible Designs for the Blind, and Chris Lockie from the Kansas City Public Works Department for speaking with me today about accessible pedestrian signals in Kansas City.
You are listening to Transit Talk on Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Janet Rogers with Transit Action Network. You can find us at transactionkc.com, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. I'm speaking with Amanda Greer, Air Quality Program Manager at Mid-America Regional Council and the person who manages the rideshare program. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Janet. Happy to be here.
Great. Amanda, what is the role of carpooling in our region?
Yeah, carpooling in Kansas City plays a great supplement to transit, biking, walking, all of the alternative modes of transportation. A lot of people ride alone in their vehicles to work, and carpooling provides an opportunity for people who maybe don't have access to a bus route or choose not to take the bus to get to work in a way that doesn't require them to drive by themselves. So through carpooling, people can save money on gas, they can save wear and tear on their vehicle, maybe it'll keep them on time a little bit more. If they're always running late, they can get a carpool who's always running on time and get them on time to work more often. And it also allows people to build up a higher level of camaraderie among their fellow employees. They get to know their coworkers a little bit better, and so they can form these friendships that can carry into the office or extracurricular activities. And carpooling, you know, you don't even have to necessarily work with the person that you're carpooling with, especially if you work at a place like Corporate Woods or downtown. You can carpool with people that work at different companies but nearby, and maybe share the cost of parking or share the fuel cost. You know, there's a lot of benefits to carpooling.
That's a really good idea. And I think you did a study recently that talked about the ways that people go to work, what their work trips were like. Mm-hmm. And carpooling actually is a large share of that, isn't it?
Yeah, so we use census data mainly to determine how people are getting to work. And the census data tells us that about 9% of the people in Kansas City are actually already using carpooling. So 1 in 10 people are already carpooling to work. So if you think about, you work at a company with a few hundred people, there's probably some options of people to carpool with already.
It's really interesting because your study showed that about 83% of the people drive alone.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put those together, 93% of the people in Kansas City drive a car or a van with other people to work, which is a lot of the people. And it's a little depressing as a transit advocate, because when I looked at the study, it says transit trips to work are only 1.3%. But as I've talked about to other people on this show, that actually makes sense, because we can't get to 82% of the jobs in this region by transit. So it's an unfortunate consequence, but it's the reality, and that's why it's so important that people do have other options besides transit, and carpooling is one of those. Now, you manage the rideshare program here at MARC.
Yeah.
Just what is that, and how does that work?
So the rideshare program at MARC supports all alternative modes of transportation, really, but our major push is commuters and carpooling. We have the rideshare.kc.org website, and you can go on that website, fill out a profile of what your commute hours are, where you're coming from and where you're going to, how many days a week you'd be interested in carpooling, and if you want to be the driver or a rider, or you can split it. And you fill out this profile, and it'll match you up with other people who have signed up on the site and want to carpool as well. And so it'll help find carpool matches for you of people that live nearby and are willing to either give a ride or looking for a ride into work. The rideshare program also runs a guaranteed ride home program. We've got the info line, which is 816-842-RIDE, where people can call and we can just help you out with general information. Maybe you're wondering, you need a little bit of help with the website, or you want some help figuring out a combination of transit routes and biking and walking and how you might be able to fit all of those things into your commute. We can also come out to your employer and help either benefits managers, or maybe you have a sustainability team at work and you want to help figure out how to encourage alternative modes at your employer. So we can come out and help anyone figure out a transportation plan for their employees where you can offer through the benefits package or through maybe you have an intranet at work, you can have a link to the rideshare site or find more information on how you can provide options and encourage alternative modes of transportation like preferred parking for carpoolers or getting involved with KCHA's trip pass program. Just anything that's workplace related, we can help develop transportation plans.
Well, it'd really be a good idea if you could find somebody to ride with that worked at the same location. That's probably a easiest way to do it.
Yeah, and a lot of companies do have internal programs where they'll pair you up with somebody or they'll help. If you come to HR or your benefits manager and say you want to do this but you're not really sure how to do it, they'll pair you up with somebody else who's doing it as well. Those programs aren't always that well promoted within the company, so not everybody knows they exist, but it'd be a good question for HR and benefits managers on that side.
So if there's nobody at my workplace that I could ride with, so you can go out and try and find a match. Does it cost me anything?
No, it's a totally free website, and how anyone deals with, you know, sharing the fuel costs or driving on certain days, that's up to the people in the carpool, but use of the website and use of the info line and all of that is completely free.
Well, what do you suggest people do when you're looking at starting to ride with a stranger?
So through the website, when you have a match, you can set up your preferences in your profile. So you can say, if you're a female and you only want to ride with females, you can select that preference. You can select smokers or non-smokers. You can select, I only want to drive or I only want to ride. You set all these things up in your profile. And then once you've been matched with somebody, you exchange messages with that person before you agree to start riding with them. So there's a method through the website to communicate. And through that approach, it's almost like going on a first date. You know, you want to make sure that you've learned some information about that person and make sure that, you know, they're going to be on time and you're going to be on time and figure out how it works. And really, if it doesn't work out, you can go back to the website and find another match. There's nothing committing you to that person or that carpool for any length of time. It's just really another resource to be able to find other people who are interested in carpooling from your area.
I guess you could try it a few days and see how you like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of things that you need to overcome. I know there's always objections that people have.
Yeah.
Like, explain the Guaranteed Ride Home program.
So the Guaranteed Ride Home program is you sign up through Mark. We manage this list. And when you've either taken the bus or carpooled or biked, walked to work, when you've taken one of these alternative modes to work and something happens, say your child gets sick at school or maybe your carpool driver gets sick and they have to go home and all of a sudden you're left without a carpool driver, you give us a call. We'll ask you a couple questions about, you know, how you got to work that day and where you need to go. And then we'll call a taxi for you and they'll come pick you up, and up to two times a year you can get a free ride home or to the hospital if you need to go there, to your child's school. You can make up to one stop on that journey. So say you need to stop at CVS and pick something up for a child who's sick, you can make one stop on that trip and we'll get you home for free.
Well, that should overcome a lot of people's objections and fear of being stranded.
Yeah, absolutely.
And flexibility, you don't have to do this every day even with the carpool, do you? You
No.
can still ride the bus occasionally.
Right. So say, you know, your kid has baseball practice on Tuesday nights and another child has ballet lessons on Thursday nights, and so you know you can't do it those nights. So you could take the carpool on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays and then drive yourself on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but at least you're still saving time and money on those 3 days a week. Or, you know, maybe you've got a couple days you can work at home, but you want to carpool on the days you have to go into the office. You know, it's really flexible and you don't need to commit to doing anything 5 days a week. And a lot of people, or I've heard anecdotal stories certainly about people who start carpooling maybe 2 days a week and then they inch it up to three, and then all of a sudden they're really not driving to work alone at all anymore because they realize how easy and cost effective it is to carpool.
Yeah, it would save a lot of money if you only drive even half of the time.
Right.
Yeah, I have a friend who carpools with four people,
mm-hmm.
and so they each drive 1 week a month.
Yeah.
And it saves them all so much money, it's fantastic.
Sure.
I know that one of the things you do as part of all this is you organize what's called a yearly Green Commute Challenge. Can you explain that to us?
Sure, yeah. So the Green Commute Challenge is an annual commuter challenge, and it runs generally, for the past few years, it's run for the months of June, July, and August. So we start on the first business day of June, and it ends on the last business day of August, and you log your commutes during those times. And telecommuting is an option that you can log as well. Walking, biking, carpooling, taking the bus. You log how you got to work those days during the challenge, and you earn points for those days. The reason it's during June, July, and August is that's also the height of the ozone season. And so the highest ozone forming potential is during those months. It's hot and sunny outside, and that's when ozone pollution builds up. And so we're trying to help the air quality issues at the same time as reducing congestion and reducing people's transportation costs. So you log those trips during June, July, and August. We have different size employer categories, and those employers compete against each other. And at the end, we have monthly prizes, we have weekly prizes, we get donations from the Royals and the Chiefs and Powell Gardens and all kinds of different places, cool prizes. And then at the end, we have lunch where we congratulate the winners and we talk about what's new for next year, and we always make sure to listen to feedback and make sure we're constantly improving. And so we've been doing this challenge for about 7 or 8 years now, and it's certainly an evolution from year to year as we listen to feedback from everybody, but it's definitely a lot of the feedback we get is that it's a lot of fun competing. Every year, about half of our participants are new, and they're trying a new alternative mode, and they've gotten to know their coworkers better. It's really a great little challenge in the summer.
We just finished that, so who won?
We did. We just finished the 2015 Green Commute Challenge, and in our large employer category, UMB won this year, and then in our medium employer category, Stinson Leonard Street won. And actually, in our small employer category, it was a group of people that work or live out near New Century and Gardner, and so they formed a team on their own, not from any individual employer, but sort of an independent team they formed, and they won in the small category.
Well, I can understand that, because if they get all the miles from Gardner,
sure.
They have a lot of miles
right.
Every day.
But they're the one, you know, saving the most. And when you've got that long of a commute, you have the most to save from your carpool.
Okay, so can you tell us again what the contact information is for people who are interested in this?
Sure. All of our information is available on the Rideshare website at RideshareKC.org. You can also give us a call at 816-842-RIDE or 816-842-7433. And there's someone to answer that phone during business hours Monday through Friday. And then if you have a question on the weekend or you want to just send us an email, we're at rideshare@mark.org.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Sheila Sterun and her guests, Janet Barlow and Chris Locke, as well as my guest, Amanda Greer. I'm Janet Rogers with Transit Action Network, and you can contact me at transactionkc@gmail.com. Our next Transit Talk on Radioactive Magazine is October 27th with Tom Guerin, the Executive Director of the Kansas City Streetcar Authority. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.